Today on Marketing Mavericks, we talk all about how to market your app, freemium versus premium, why you should listen to your reviewers, and how to make your app sticky. Coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Marketing Mavericks is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 52 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off image subscription packages on your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code MM415. And by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Go to Squarespace.com and enter offer code MM at checkout to get 10% off. This is Marketing Mavericks, episode 51, recorded Thursday, April 16, 2015. Marketing your app. Welcome to Marketing Mavericks, where we talk about everything at the intersection of marketing and technology. And today we're going to talk about the intersection of apps and marketing. You created this great app. What do you do with it? In fact, what do you need to know before you get it created? I'm Tanya Hall, your host of Marketing Mavericks. And we're excited. We've got a really interesting guest that's going to talk all about how to get your app sticky. Yep, that's right. You're going to need a wet wipe after this. And our technical director, Anthony Nielsen.
Hey, how's it going?
How's
your trip?
Blue bonnets. That's the word. Blue bonnets.
Blue bonnets.
Everywhere. Have you been to Texas?
Yes, once. But it was a long time ago and I don't really remember.
It wasn't sticky for you, was it?
No.
This time of year, it's the spring, this special weekend, pretty much one weekend or so, where there's tons of wildfires, but there's one that's, there are blue bonnets and the hillsides, very rolling hills. And it's like the hill country is mostly where I went. And it was really beautiful. Lots of rolling hills of this blue color, this like royal blue color. And this fragrance, it's amazing. So I had a really good time. My niece also got married, much more important than the flowers, but it was all good. It was a lot of fun. She did the whole thing off Pinterest, by the way.
What?
It's my one Pinterest plug for the show.
We'll see about that.
What?
You like to plug Pinterest.
I do. I like Pinterest. Our guest is pretty interesting, too. We've actually had some requests for Marketing Mavericks. So talk about how to actually promote software and apps. And today we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what do you need to know before you build your app as it relates to marketing. And I know some people think marketing isn't for them, but we're all in sales and we're all marketing our whole lives. It's just about a matter of promoting a product. And today we're going to talk about how to promote your app and how to get the top rankings, how to be successful from product and pricing to literally the design and color of your app and how you should promote it, what you should do when customers talk about it. Our guest today is Ariel McAley. He is the founder and CEO of App Figures. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You did hear that I went to Texas, right? And the blue bonnets. Where? Now, you're in New York.
I am.
Are you from New York?
Jersey, originally.
Jersey. Yep. Are we going to talk about little Jersey?
Do you want to?
There's two places I imagine not. There's big hair in Texas and in New Jersey, right? Big hair? It was a thing when I was growing up. I grew up in Texas. Yeah, I had really big hair.
I figured.
It was not
the Texas port, not the hair port. That I never guess.
The hair, yeah, it was very big. So we're really excited to have you join us today. You actually are the founder, not just CEO, but the founder and CEO of App Figures. How long has App Figures been in business?
We've been around for a little bit more than 6 years now. We actually just celebrated the sixth birthday a few weeks ago. So that was crazy.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And in this business, that's actually a pretty long time.
I would like to think so, yes.
And but this isn't your first venture into starting a company. You and I had a pretty lengthy conversation about some of the things that you've done. This is your ninth startup, correct?
That's correct.
talk about like what happened before your very first startup and why you decided to get into this business in general. Give us a little background on who you are.
Sure. So background on who I am, I started really young. When I graduated high school, I decided, let's open a web hosting company because web hosting is not cool and not many people even know what it is, but I want to do it. So I somehow got a server and I put it all together, and then we actually did web hosting for a little bit. We had a huge data loss problem and we closed the business shortly thereafter. But a lot of things that I learned about running a business and also about technology really translated well into the businesses that followed. So it was a really great experience all in all.
So
there. No, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to say, so you got started, but it didn't burn you out of it. I mean, obviously nine startups later. What was the business that you and I were talking about this morning? Because here's the funny thing. So before the show got started, I was talking about, I was teasing Anthony about Snapchat, and I was teasing you about being on Tinder, which you said you were at one point.
I tried. I experimented. Everyone experiments.
Everyone, well, I don't know. Maybe. It's a good thing in our business to actually know what's out there. You actually started, it was your second startup that was a dating site?
That's correct.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was growing up in a small town in Jersey, and I wanted to see what the internet can be used for before the days Match.com was huge and before the days of Tinder and OkCupid and all those. And I love technology from a very young age. Probably even before I was 10 years old. My dad is a programmer and he really got me into it. So I said, let's put dating online and see what happens. Let's put meeting new people online. It went well. It's me and a friend from high school that we decided to do it. And for quite a few months, it actually slowly took off. Eventually, we went off to college and completely forgot about it. So it never really became a business. But it was nice. There were real people, real profiles, real pictures on for a while.
Yeah, I used to go, I think I've said this before on the show, I used to go into European chat rooms just to meet people and get to know them. And I did my, trying a dating app when I was in Dallas. And what I found was that it just wasn't, you and I talked about this, I felt like it was just not for me, because even though I wanted to meet people and make friends, I don't think everyone on the site was that had the same intentions. And so for me, it really didn't work. But, you know, so many people get married. My niece, in fact, I was talking just before the show that she got married this weekend. And they met on POF, Plenty of Fish. And so it happens. People meet all the time on these sites. But yours, you know, that wasn't your thing. And you've gone
a much different experience. I think it really depends on what you start out seeking or what you're looking for, really. So when I was growing up, I was on chats on IRC, on ICQ, if you remember those days. And it was a much different sort of conversation when it came to meeting new people online, just making friends, not even necessarily meeting for real. So I thought we can take that, we can translate it and bring it closer to real life. And that didn't really happen.
Yeah. Now, you're nine startups later. I'm sure, learned a lot across the way. What was one of your biggest takeaways from, you know, starting and stopping and starting and stopping? I mean, you know, that you just kept reinventing a new product and getting out there. You've had this one now, congratulations again, for 6 years. So you clearly go. You're doing something right. What was your biggest takeaway that you took into starting this company?
I think the one thing that a lot of people don't realize is the importance of the business aspect of running a company. You can have an amazing product, and that's kind of like what we talked about before the show. It doesn't matter how awesome your product is. If no one knows that it exists, no one is going to be able to get it. And there's so many ways to spread the word, whether it's through your friends, through word of mouth, through actual campaigns and advertising, that you got to see the value that marketing brings to the table. And you got to think about the business as a whole and not just one product or one service that you're working on. That's really a big takeaway.
And I see the importance here. We were talking also about your start in the gaming side of the business. And that's how I started working. I kind of left traditional marketing, working in cable television, working on the programmer side, Viacom and Starz, that sort of thing. And I left that business and I started working with startups and specifically in the gaming industry, game developers. This was even before the days of Facebook, where we were putting things on Facebook's platform versus, you know, traditional websites. And and then we moved into Facebook, and games have always been really huge. Tell me about your experience being in the gaming side. And you talk about your brother being the great coder that you actually are in business with, and you're the marketing guy. I think he calls you the suit, right?
Yep. I call myself the suit sometimes. It happens. So a little background on my brother. He is a computer engineer, really great when it comes to building awesome code, architecting great code. And so his career started slightly different than mine, where I wanted to go and sell things to everyone and make products people really like. He wanted to make games. So from a very young age, early high school, he started getting into game development and engine development for games. And for him, the web was a way of using his game skills and making money out of them, whereas making games was just a side thing, more of a hobby. But what we're able to do is just by having those two businesses kind of happen side by side, we were able to turn the game development business into a business and not just a side or a hobby, a side project or a hobby. And so in 2004, 2005, we somehow got into creating interactive entertainment, which really means games as advertising for big companies like Yahoo and NBC and Kellogg's. And we were using a lot of our own engines that made us very popular back then. The one we use the most is the physics engine with an F, physics with an F. And I think there's still a site for it if you Google it. I haven't seen it in a very long time. And that enabled you to have realistic physics in a Flash game. And I know Flash doesn't exist anymore, but it used to be pretty big, if you remember those days. And that's how we got into gaming, and that's how we became more popular in gaming. And we got a lot of professional experience building them and selling them. And that's also ultimately what led us to build games for the iPhone, which led us to where AppFigures is today. So one thing leads into another.
I want to talk about what needs to go into the mind frame of somebody who says, okay, I want to develop, before they even write their first line of code, what are the things they need to think about? What do they need to know from a marketing perspective? Because so many times, Ariel, I've worked with startups who they have this brilliant idea, they've put everything together, but they didn't once think about it from a marketing perspective. And there were so many things that they should have included, or maybe that they should have thought about up front, because I come into the picture when they're ready, they realize they have this great product and they don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to promote it. They don't know how to get people excited about it. They don't know how to market and sell, or maybe they do, but they haven't really applied those skills to what it is that they're trying to accomplish. And there's some really important questions. I want to talk about all of that. But before I do, I actually want to thank a sponsor of Marketing Mavericks, which is Shutterstock. This episode of Marketing Mavericks is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect image or video for your next creative project. Whether it's for your website or a publication or maybe an advertisement, a video, or any other type of project, you can choose from over 52 million, that's so many, high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips. You clearly have a lot of choices. Shutterstock sources images from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional photographers and artists. Shutterstock reviews each image individually for content and quality before adding it to its library. And Shutterstock adds 385,000 images every week. So every time you visit, you'll find something new. Shutterstock is flexible pricing. You can choose individual packs or monthly subscription for the best deal. You can download 25 images a day with just a standard subscription. And you can download any image in any size and pay only one price. Shutterstock gives you the images you need to bring your creative projects to the next level, and they make it easy. Shutterstock has sophisticated search tools. You can search and drill down by subject, color, palette, file type, gender, emotion, and so much more. Shareable lightboxes helps you save images to a lightbox gallery, then access them anytime and share them with other team members. An award-winning iPad app. That's right. That's award-winning. Search on the go and use it to display images during presentations. In fact, I think, you know, as a business person, you really want to have really great, high-quality presentations. And you're going to have lots of images. You can include your team. This is going to really be that detail that's going to help you stand out, I don't know, to your competition and certainly make you look good in front of your clients. In fact, if you have issues, Shutterstock has multilingual customer service in more than a dozen international countries and full-time customer support throughout the week. So you can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save favorite images to a Lightbox to review later. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code MM415. That's MM415, and new accounts will receive 20% off image subscription packages. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off subscription packages on new accounts, use offer code MM415. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Marketing Mavericks, and keep your presentations looking great. I can tell you as a marketer, I will look at somebody's presentation and think, gosh, they really didn't have their act together. Shutterstock will help you do that. Now we're going to get back to our guest who's talking about not only what you need to know for a presentation, but what you need to know long before you actually build your code, before you probably write the first line of code. What is somebody that is excited about starting and maybe creating an app? What do they need to know up front? What kind of questions should they be asking themselves or their team?
You know, it really depends. I think it's all about the type of app and the type of experience you want to put out there. If you have a free app that's going to the masses and you're not really sure about pricing, but you just want to try it out, build some audience, that's one thing. If you want to build a real company and actually, you know, spark a real sort of engagement that gets you money, that's a totally different consideration. I think, in my opinion, you need to go for the latter all the time. Because if you have something that's not generating revenue, it's not a sustainable business. And so the real question that I ask is, how much can we charge and how? And whether it's as an app, a free app with in-app purchases, a paid app, whether it's a subscription-based service, that would really depend on the app itself. But there needs to be something. There needs to be value that someone can consume and pay for.
So when you think about pricing, right? So there's free apps, as you pointed out. There's paid apps. I was telling you, you know, I think probably the most I've ever spent on an app was this $10, and I'm not sure I ever used it again. But there's tons of free apps that I use constantly every day. So how do you know as an app developer where you should price your app? I mean, I've actually been asked that question, you know, Tanya, I have no idea what I should price my app to be. How do you coach somebody on that math, that, you know, showing your work, if you will?
That is a pretty good question. I don't think there's one silver bullet. I don't think there's one formula you can adhere to and boom, you'll get the best price. It's a matter of experimentation, but it's really about knowing your audience. If you are aiming for a big audience and you know they're going to try you out and maybe buy in the future, go with a freemium model. Just find a way to package it in a way that's easy enough for them to get. And then a way that they can then give you more money as they see the value in the app. But otherwise, a subscription-based service is probably a good solution for some companies, depending, again, on the kind of service that's being provided. And what's odd is I've seen a lot of new companies choosing the subscription route over a freemium model because they know that even though it doesn't really make a lot of sense, users will pay for it. And a good example of that is fitness apps. I have downloaded a bunch of fitness apps recently. I wanted to find a 7-minute workout app that works. I don't think any of them work, but some of them look really good and got me to actually work out, some of them less so. And the ones that did were the ones that had content that continued to update all the time. And for that, they charged a monthly fee or they give you an annual sort of fee. And on the one hand, the consumer in me didn't like it because I don't want to pay for something I know you have a library of and you're just dripping to me over time. But as a marketer and as a business person, I do see the value because those app developers, app companies, they need to continue and sustain themselves. And this is a great way to continue in marketing it, to continue in creating content that at some point I will use when I go to the gym.
Well, I mean, the gym industry in general is, and a lot of other memberships are the same way. You sign up in the beginning and let's face it, you may not use it for a while. You might. Hopefully you're using your gym membership. But if you don't, you're still paying for it, right? Most of us don't think to cancel something right away. They think, you know, I should really cancel that. And they don't. So it is ongoing revenue for a lot of these apps. But there's so many apps out there that are free. How are those guys actually successful in making money? How do they end up in the top rankings and actually pays off of them?
I think there's no such thing as really free. You'll see a lot of apps that are kind of free, either promoting other apps from the same developer or finding a way to charge you for something else, whether against a subscription or an in-app purchase you may only need under some use cases. So there's always a paid component. Now, also another way to monetize your apps is advertising, which I completely left out in the beginning. And I think up until fairly recently, advertising was pretty monotonic, pretty simple. You put a banner in your app, you make some money, and that's that. But what we're seeing now with the video ads and opt-in ads is a whole new way to monetize that actually isn't that bad and isn't that intrusive for developers. So I think ads on their own are now becoming a great way to monetize. And that will allow free apps to be more successful.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask. What is the comparison then for somebody who says, okay, I think I want to go with an advertising-based app model versus, you know, charging maybe 99 cents for the app and it's completely ad-free to the consumer? What's the upside? Sounds like there's a whole lot more of more work behind an ad-based model. Is there that much more revenue to be made, or, you know, what's the lion's share? What's the math between the, choosing those two options?
I think there are really two variables that you have to think about when you do that. One variable is how you want your app to be perceived. Do you want your app to be perceived as something that was done so you can make advertising revenue? Because that's, at the end of the day, what most of those apps look like. Or do you want your app to be seen as a professional tool that, or an app that is packaged for the user, for the consumer? But the other thing you have to think about is how engaged is your audience? If your app, or if my app, is something you as a consumer download and keep and run once a year, I'm not going to make a lot of money as a developer on advertising. I need you to come back every day. And not all apps actually fit that sort of model. Some do, some don't. So that's something very important to keep an eye on.
How important? So so there's obviously different ways to monetize and create pricing. You've actually talked about some pretty expensive apps that have actually ended up in, you know, in top rankings with certainly in the Apple Store. What makes somebody actually end up at the top? Like, is there some sort of, you know, little pixie dust that you sprinkle on your code that causes it you to just be really successful? Do you have a really great marketing strategy? Do you have a niche app or product? Because there's so many apps out there, it's hard to believe there's something that's very different that's just going to completely stand out. But is that the key, standing out?
I think it's all of the above, minus pixie dust, because that's hard to come by these days. If you think about being on the App Store, so the App Store has more than 1.4 million apps as of right now, and that's only the Apple App Store. How do you stand out, and what does it even mean to stand out? How does someone get to you? And I think the reason why some apps bubble to the top and some apps are sticky, as we call them before, is because they have a good mix of advertising outside of the App Store and good marketing outside of the App Store, and also a great way to share, because that's the sharing economy, all that fun stuff. It really works if your app is something that excites people. So the app I mentioned when we spoke before was Facetune, that is currently, I believe, number 4 on the top 8 apps, and it's a $3.99 app, which is pretty expensive to be at the top. I would not expect that app to be anywhere near the top 25 even, but through a lot of pricing experimentation, and we looked at probably the last 3 years of that particular app, they changed a lot of different variables when it comes to pricing. They tried a lot of different things, and they eventually found what works. And what works isn't what everyone else is doing. It's what's best for their consumers, for their audience. Through user acquisition, through advertising on Twitter, I believe I saw their app on, they got to a point where they have enough downloads and they're sustainable enough that the ranks actually just carry themselves. And that's really where you want to be. Now, if you look at everything they have, it's all clean, it's all clear, it's all simple. I think something like that reduces the risk that me as a consumer would have going into the App Store and looking for something to play with pictures.
Zombie Girl in the chat room made a point of talking about a custom-made app that isn't necessarily in iTunes. And, you know, she, you know, wrote a pretty descriptive question. But basically, I think what she wants to know is, what to do with Apple iOS updates, and it could break the app because it wasn't maybe created within those parameters. Like, how do you advise somebody on a custom app versus, I guess, one that that when Apple updates could be broken.
I have no idea what that means. I'll be very honest.
I know. It's in the chat room. I was trying to read it, but it's hard to read. And then
Is a customer? Like custom UI versus...
here's what she's got. I'm actually just going to read it. Tanya, my experience with a custom developed iOS app, not in iTunes Store, but rather personally distributed to support a web service, has been extremely wonky. Apple iOS updates could break it. For example, can Ariel speak to this type of distribution and ways to reduce bad UEX?
If I understand correctly, we're talking about the a different way to distribute apps, which is not through the store, but rather through an enterprise agreement with Apple or an enterprise publisher account, enterprise developer account, one of those, which allows you to give the app to someone in your area for having on their device and running on their device. It was really meant for enterprises to be able to distribute to their employees really quickly. I don't know why anyone would actually use that in production to make money, but I do see the value if you have a small organization and you don't want to go through the hassle of submitting your app to Apple for review and Apple saying what they think, whether they like it or not, and going through that whole process. As far as Apple breaking things, Apple releases iOS once a year, so there's not a lot of breakage that goes on. But if the question has to do with custom UI versus native UI, then things like iOS 7 will definitely break it. I think that's the answer to the question.
You know, that kind of leads to creating custom apps. I think, you know, there are, I was talking to somebody last weekend about creating apps for their clients. So it's more of a B2B scenario versus a B2C scenario where, you know, consumers just go, they buy, it's a numbers game, right? You want more mm-hmm. people to have your app. Well, in this case, they have a limited number of customers, but they want to create an app for their customers to use. So all of their perceived app users are going to be clients, and it's going to be very specific. Do you advise through your company, do you advise people on a B2B platform, B2C? I mean, what is your profile of your customer look like?
We're actually really all over the place. When we started AppFigures, we started it as something we really needed. And as something we really needed, we didn't want to limit the kind of customer that would come on board. And we said, let's build something the indie developer can build and can use when building apps, and also big enterprises and also agencies who may not have many millions of customers, but just a few. So we have really solutions for all of them. And that's been actually pretty good for us because it allows us to learn from all those different users. And we get features from the indies that enterprises love. We get features from the enterprise that indies love. It really gives us that flexibility and the platform, the power to help everyone at the end.
What about making your app look different? You know, one of the questions Leo had for Ben Rubin, who's the founder of Meerkat, was, hey, your app is yellow. There's another really popular app that's yellow. Is color, I mean, are simple things like color, design, those things, are they really going to help or hinder the success of your app?
Oh, absolutely. I think you can say that about pretty much every product. And you see it a lot on the App Store because it's so easy to make apps these days. And sometimes they're not well designed. Sometimes they're pretty terrible. And it's very easy to separate the good from the bad. But your question about colors is actually pretty interesting because at the end of the day, if there's a sea of apps and your app stands out, people will see you. And if people see you, people will read your description. If you have a video, they'll watch your video. And if you have enough good ratings and they actually need it, they're going to download it, especially if it's free and they don't see a need to pay for it. So being a little bit different is always great on the App Store. Being a lot different, probably even better. If it's not because of design, if it's because of specific language, maybe the language of your description is really friendly. Maybe you have really awesome release notes when you have a new update. Maybe your icon is just really clever. And I think that's actually changing icon cleverness because of the whole flatness in iOS 7 and iOS 8. But colors on the icon will still make you stand out. So if, for example, I search for a term on the App Store and all the results have a red icon, why would I want my app to also have a red icon to confuse everyone? I'll make it orange. I'll make it blue. I'll make it stand out. And the eye of the consumer will immediately just get attracted to it.
What should somebody think about when they're getting ready to select an app based on the type of app? So, for example, you have some apps, it seems like, are in the social space. They're all blue. What's up? Why are they all blue? I don't know. You have some, you know, in the health space that pick green. I mean, is there some sort of strategy behind the color that what people that is being used? I mean, do we have any numbers behind what colors are more successful, or is it very industry based? Or do you guys look at that?
We do a little bit. We're actually working on a side project that is a search engine for app icons by color. So you can look for all the successful apps that are blue, for example. It's not live yet, but that is indeed something we're looking at. And I think really what it is, it's herd mentality at the end of the day. So an app that is very famous is blue in the social media space, and everyone wants to be the same. An app that is green in the health industry space is something people want to be like and want to be perceived as being similar to. So I think that's really what it is. Someone invents something and people follow it. I mean, there is a lot to color and color theory and feelings related to colors. I'm probably not the best person to give you insights on those because I'm not a designer.
Where's your brother? What?
Yeah, exactly.
He's the guy.
Go find him. I'm going to go drag him. He's probably not going to be happy. He's going to give you some great answers and leave. That's really what it is.
You know, is it hard to work with a family member like that you're that close with? Is it? Do you guys tend to agree or get along?
We get along very well. We never agree. I think that's a very big difference. Everyone actually asks the same question. I think our relationship, the entire family is very close. So for us, it's easy. We trust each other very much and we know we're good at our respective roles. But we do tend to disagree very often. And I think people around us also notice when we do. It's fun and it's great.
What is one of the biggest questions you get by app developers who are just getting started? What's probably the number one question that comes to mind?
How do I get featured?
What do you say?
There is no magic bullet. I actually did a panel on that a few months ago, and we had some really big game developers, some really small big game developers who were just giving us their experiences. And the ultimate question was, what do I need to do in order to get featured? And there isn't an answer for that because getting featured on the App Store is a manual process. It's a personal process. And it has a lot to do with some of the items we mentioned before for reducing risk. If your language is great, if your app is well designed, if the color is really pop. But it's also a complete guess. If you land at the right time in the right place, Apple wants to feature a social app and you happen to have a social app, it's just going to happen. Our second game actually got featured by Apple a whole bunch of times. And we have no idea why. We didn't ask for it. We weren't really told when it was featured. It kind of just happened all on its own.
You have talked about pricing a little bit and, you know, what somebody should know about pricing. Do you have any data to show whether or not free apps tend to go higher in the rankings? It seems like they would, right? More people are going to download a free app because they know there's no actual investment of, you know, monetary investment or personal investment in the success of the app. Whereas somebody who's actually paying for even a 99 cents for an app is going to feel a little more loyal. Do you have any data to show that actually paying for an app? Because I know I've done this research on paying for products before, and I've you know, historically tried to, you know, talk to clients about the fact that you can't trust the fact that you're giving something to somebody for free because they won't really value it. When they've actually paid for it, they're going to value the service, and you see that your retention is higher. You've got more loyalty with customers and retention is higher. Do you have any data that supports that kind of theory?
We do. We actually looked at the number of apps that are paid versus the number of apps that are free versus the number of apps that monetize within app purchases quite a few times on the App Store, and they're all on our blog, blog.appfigures.com. And what we've seen is what you say is actually very true, but the perception on the App Store has changed. So in the beginning, there was the race to the bottom where the apps that have taken maybe even years to build are only 99 cents. And that happened. But then after that, as apps started to go more freemium, what we're seeing is that consumers are actually looking for free apps. They don't want to pay for apps. And you see this more happening on the Google Play Store and some even on the Amazon Store. But it's also happening on Apple's iOS Store. So consumers are not necessarily because they're paying or more loyal. It's the consumers who are not paying who have high expectation just as high as a paid app that they paid $9.99 or even more for. And it's very interesting to see, as time goes on, more and more apps actually are moving away from the paid model, because paid model, you monetize once and you're kind of married forever. You have to continue updating the app. You have to continue maintaining the app and making it better. Otherwise, the users who paid you feel like they've been cheated out of their money. Whereas free apps, where you don't pay a penny, but you do or you can pay for an update or for additional value, are really just happy with what they've been getting because they feel like it's free. I don't deserve it, and yet I got it for free. And a lot more apps are doing it right now because it provides some sort of a trial also effect, which is not something Apple actually has natively. So I see more apps moving towards the freemium model. The real problem is that freemium model is not really easy to monetize. It's much easier to just slap a price on your app and go to town with it. But if you really take the time to think about it, and that's what many developers are doing right now, and that's the trend, you can monetize much, much better.
What about marketing based on, so, you know, I have an iPad, but I'm also an Android user, and so my phone is Android. So talk about the strategy behind where do you go first? Do you go to iOS first? Do you go to Android? And is your marketing strategy going to be different based on those two differences?
Oh, absolutely. You have to keep in mind that the different audiences are actually completely different. Whether it's a matter of pricing, some apps change your pricing model when they go to a different store if they're not a service. Whether it's the colors, whether it's the experience, you want to be more in line with the actual devices or the actual platform's experience. On iOS, it would have to be more flat, more simple. On Android, it would have to be more material design-y. Everything flows a little bit different. And I think it makes a lot of sense to actually stick to those standards. And when we think about here internally, think about platforms, we see them as completely independent. So you on your iPhone may not want or may not even care about what an app, the same app looks like on an Android. Or you on an Android may not even think to check the iPhone version. And you actually may have multiple devices, but most people don't. Most people don't try even. So keeping the experience native when it comes to UI is something that to me is very important and to me is really crucial to success of any app. Whether to go both or go one first will depend really on your audience. I know AppFigures members started with iOS. So for us, it would be the iOS market. It would be Apple. But so many other companies have gone Android first to validate their model and make sure that their app actually works, their backend actually works on that kind of scale. So I think you can go both ways. I think really ultimately, if we had a way to make apps that could easily go natively into iOS and also into Android and also maybe into Windows, if anyone cares, with a similar or the same code base, that's really a huge win for all of us.
I want to talk about basically competition in general, but also in other countries. Like, how do you make your app more successful in other countries? I want to talk about the reviews, how important reviews are, and how app developers should actually pay attention to reviews and their whole big marketing and customer care mix, as well as something you're pretty excited about, which is the Apple Watch. But before I do, I want to thank another sponsor of Marketing Mavericks, which is Squarespace. This episode of Marketing Mavericks is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code MM at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, it is easy for you to create a professional website, blog, or online store. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. In fact, many of our guests have talked about the fact that they have used Squarespace, and I've had many of them say that after the show, they actually went and created their own Squarespace account because it is so important to have a really professional looking website. You don't have to hire a really expensive website developer. You can actually use Squarespace and have a beautiful product. It's simple, it's powerful, and beautiful. making changes is clearer and simpler than ever. Incredibly easy to use. And if you want some help, Squarespace has a live chat and email support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Squarespace starts at just $8 a month, and they take care of the hosting so you don't have to. Plus, you get a free domain name if you buy Squarespace for a year. All Squarespace websites are responsive and scale to look great on any device. E-commerce is also available. Every website comes with a free online store. With Cover Pages, you can set up a beautiful one-page online presence in minutes. It's perfect for creating quick landing pages for your brand, personal identity, or to promote a new product. Plus, Squarespace is hiring engineers who are ready for that next step in their career. That's why they created NY Commit, an initiative that will select up to 10 engineers from all over America to experience the history, vibrancy, and diversity of New York City. Apply today, and if you interview before April 30th, you and your spouse or partner will get to spend a complimentary weekend in New York City. To learn more, visit nycommit.com. That's nycommit.com. Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code MM to get 10% off your first purchase. We thank Squarespace for their support of Marketing Mavericks. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Well, that's pretty cool. And hey, if you're looking for a job, there's a nice little contest there. We'll talk more about that, sure. And to talk more about your apps and engineers who are building them, what you need to know. One of the things that we didn't talk about, but is important to every marketer who has a product that is not just in the United States or not just in one country, but in multiple countries, you want your success everywhere. How do you, approaching marketing can be really challenging. Not only do you have dialect differences and culture differences, but there's social issues you have to consider. What do you need to know in developing an app that you think will actually be global?
Well, I think before even jumping into cultural differences and any other social differences, the easiest way to take your app that you're currently selling in the U.S. And put it on all the stores is actually done by default. So your app is global, whether you like it or not. You can turn it off if you really want to, but why would you? The additional revenue is just great. But that also means that it's kind of problematic, because if your app, all the marketing material and everything inside the app is all in English and you're trying to sell to Germans, they may completely understand everything, but it's not going to feel right to them. And Apple and Google and all those companies actually solved that problem, and built into every SDK is a way to localize your app that's fairly straightforward in most cases. I'm not going to say all cases. So I think that's really step number one. Find a translator, translate your app into the four or five major languages that include Europe, South America, and some Asia. That's more of a cultural problem, but we'll talk about that in a sec. And once you get your app localized, you'll see improvements. You'll see improvements in ranks, and you'll see improvements in revenue. They may not be amazing immediately without any additional marketing or additional advertising. But think about it, for translating your apps for just a few bucks, you can get an increase in ranks, an increase in sales. That's kind of crazy. And I think everyone should do that. That just be a default for everyone. But once you get into cultural differences and social differences, that's just something you have to think about as a product. I mean, you've done marketing for websites and for companies. Have you interacted with international and global products of that scale?
I have, and I think probably one of the biggest challenges that you have is the cultural differences and how people actually respond to your brand message, how to create the message, you know, what message is going to resonate in what country, how people buy is different, how they perceive the message that you put out there, and how they actually use the product might be different. So there's a lot to consider, and it can be really challenging with any type of product, because of the fact that, you know, it's that's why even in customer service, if you think of, you know, if you've ever picked up the phone and tried to call, I mean, even if you just need somebody to help you after you buy the product, and you call and you talk to somebody that you're pretty sure isn't in the United States, they're probably not. And the biggest issue isn't dialect. It isn't the translation. of the actual words. It's the translation of culture and how we think about issues and concerns and questions, and how we communicate is so different. And that certainly overflows into marketing, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think customer service is a part of your product. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a service or an app or even a tangible product you can hold in your hand. The way you support it as a company is the way your app, your product will be perceived. So by having great support, you're reducing that perceived risk we talked about before and making yourself accessible. And that does become challenging. But since we're on the topic, one avenue or one channel that most developers have access to but don't really utilize very well, in my opinion, would be App Store reviews. So you put your app on the App Store and it may be really successful, may not. You've probably got enough users to give you some feedback about the app. And they will do that in the form of reviews. Some may say the app is terrible. Some may say the app is great. But some will actually give you great feedback. And whether it's an idea on how to improve or just highlight something you did really, really well that you can use in your marketing copy now that you know the use case. So listening to them and using what your users are saying is actually a huge benefit that you're getting from App Store reviews. Now, I think the real problem is they're not really easy to get to. If you open up iTunes, you have to switch between the different countries and go through one by one, and that's just a huge pain. So we actually built a whole dashboard, a whole engine that collects all those and translates them for you. So we collect reviews from 155 countries for Apple developers, I believe 30 different languages for Google Play developers, and we bring all of them into this one big engine, translated them into the language of your choice, be it English or not, and then give you a way to search through them. So if you're looking for a bug, you can easily find all the bugs in your app. And this is free feedback. This is coming directly from your users who are essentially your testers. So regardless of the country, listening and providing this level of support and giving them the exposure, so making them understand you're listening to them and you're doing what they're asking you to do, is going to go a really long way. Whether you localize or not, it's pretty unanimous.
I can't tell you how important that is. Listening to your customers is something that Microsoft has not done very well in the past. and I'm going to call them out on it, because I think, you know, that's something that if they did implement better listening tools and using social media to do that, using the internet, listening to the feedback from customers. One of the things that you mentioned, I don't know if you use the term loyalty, but you gain a lot of loyalty, because that way when you do make mistakes or you have a bug in your app or something happens to your product, you've actually still gained their loyalty because they know you're listening and they know you're trying. It's when you don't listen and you go off on your own that they abandon you. I think that's pretty key. Customer service is...
It's absolutely true, in my opinion. And that's why we have, from day one, we had great customer service and we're trying our best, whether it's on live chat or an email or a phone or anything else. Because it's kind of like when you have a problem, you don't have a safety net if you don't have a good customer service to back you up. And we always like to provide that sort of safety net, because I'm in the same shoes sometimes. I call a company and I'm trying to use their product and I can't, and it's so frustrating and they're not helping me and I just leave because I feel like they don't care. But sometimes with companies that I really like, when they break something, when I use software that's broken and I get in touch and I say, hey, it's broken, and they fix it immediately, I feel even better than a software that just works. It's kind of weird, but that just that sort of a feeling that I have a safety net. I can go to them, they'll make everything work.
And they care about you. You feel like they care about you. And we've seen that over and over again. That's why social media, using the quote signs, has been so popular, because people feel like they have that face-to-face connection with the service provider or the person behind that the customer service person. Chris P. in the chat room is asking, Tanya, is Google Translate a viable option for translating, or should you spend the cash for a good translator? What would you say to that, Ariel?
Spend the cash. Google Translate is a terrible way to translate.
Agreed.
When you need to have a marketing message. If it's a short sentence that you were trying to translate when doing customer service, for example, someone is asking you a question in a language you don't speak, you can run it through. It may not make sense on the other end, but you'll kind of figure it out because you know your product, you understand the flow. If you try to take a marketing message from one language that you know into a language you don't, you have no idea what's going to come out on the other end. And that might just be really funny.
There have been some huge mistakes, I think, that have been made where I think actually somebody in the marketing department just used Google Translate to actually try to, you know what, there's so much behind going into really connecting. And it's like we talked about before, you know, when you talk to somebody in a customer support position, you really want them to understand you, not just the words that you're trying to say, but exactly. what's coming from behind that. That's still one of the biggest challenges we have today, I think, when it comes to customer service. So
communications are tough in general in life.
One of the things that you got really excited about when we kind of had our pre-show conversation was, dun, 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 the Apple Watch. You think this is going to change everything. Why is that?
Because it's new and it's awesome. No, I'm just kidding. It is pretty nice. I'm looking at it from the developer perspective. So when the iPhone came out back in 2008, there were 500 apps in the App Store on day one. And that ballooned to 65,000, I think, within 12 months. When the iPad came out, there were 3,000 apps in the App Store. That skyrocketed to more than 100,000. I think with the Apple Watch, we'll see a brand new App Store that we've never had before. And it's probably going to open with between three and 5,000 apps. But that's also going to skyrocket because everyone would want to have an extension. It's just going to be so easy. And again, just like localizing your apps, that's easy enough. Thinking about a watch experience should be fairly straightforward for most app developers. And having that sort of exposure in this new app store that's going to skyrocket their ranks on the iOS app store is like getting featured for free. Completely free. So if someone asks me next time how to get featured, I would say make a watch app, pretty much.
And how to stay sticky? I mean, I know we've talked about it a few times throughout the show, but what's your best advice to helping someone with a sticky app?
I think it's about caring. So listening to your consumers and listening to your users, trying to figure out what they really want and then giving it to them goes a very, very long way. And they bring their friends and their friends bring their friends. And you have this network effect that can only happen when you have something that's dynamic enough and not just going off of your initial design ideas.
Is it beneficial to wait? I mean, if you're not a huge hit coming out of the gate, is it feasible to think that you're going to actually end up there by growth and just, you know, organically? Yeah. Or should you hold off and wait until you know that you think you can be have a better chance of being a big hit? Which is a better play?
I don't know. I've always believed in persistence. You start something, you iterate on it, and continue until eventually it will work. You can look at Angry Birds as a good case study. And we did a case study on it a few months ago. When they hit the App Store, they failed almost immediately. And for months, they actually continued to push and do more marketing and try to get Apple to do all these crazy things. And eventually, one of those worked. And they started climbing. And once they started climbing, there was no looking back. And it was just good and great from there on. So, of course, continue. It doesn't mean that you can cut any corners for V1. For V1, you should always have the best you can do. But it doesn't mean you need all the features. It just means you need all the polish, in my experience.
And how do you get people to get to know your product? Should you put some sort of viral campaign together? Do you just hope it's word of mouth? I mean, how do you get people to download your app?
The million-dollar question. So I think there are several big ways you can do it. Getting people to share your app, incentivizing them to share your app, whether because it's really cool or because you will love them forever or you will give them some points in the game, is actually a great way. Using social media, as you called it before, you can get to so many people and you can get to them as a friend and not as a marketer, which is something that helps a lot on the app side of things. But user acquisition through channels like Facebook and even Twitter these days is actually going great for a lot of game developers specifically. And if you open your Twitter app, you'll see apps we love or apps we recommend or something like that at the top. And that started as just native advertising in the feed, and now it's a whole new section. So it must be working for them. And I know for a fact that it is working for developers who are targeting very specific users, targeting only what they really, really need. So I think those channels are actually really, really great, whether you come as a friend or you come as a marketer. You just have to utilize them. And then keep people engaged. People who are engaged are loyal. People who are loyal will help you. They will see you as a friend and continue to spread the word. And that's really the easiest. Or you can go the many, many millions of dollars route and just pay for a lot of advertising. But that's different. Much, much different.
House of Cards has been very successful on Netflix. You guys have a blog on your website that talks about how the success of a show, maybe something on Netflix, actually translates into an app. Is that something that people who create apps should actually think about, like getting into the space of following a successful show or something that's successful in kind of real life and creating an app to follow it? Or is that lackluster? I mean, are we going to literally, can anybody really be Kevin Spacey on an app? I mean, come on. He makes the show, right?
Kind of like yes and no and maybe. So we did that blog post where Monument Valley just skyrocketed almost immediately. I don't know if they pay the show or this is just something that happened because one of the producers, even Kevin Spacey, really liked the app. But it really helped. So yeah, absolutely. If you have this sort of tie-in, and I mean, a show like that is a huge scale sort of tie-in. But I've heard from other developers who make more niche products that they've found another sort of stage. Maybe it's not a TV show, but it's a manufacturer of a physical product who can recommend the app. Maybe it's a service provider who can recommend the app. You can go to them and you can create these little partnerships where others share your app on and in scale. But something else that's interesting, I don't make any sense anymore, is we did a blog post on the success of the Super Bowl ads. And in case you you didn't see them, there are a few for Clash of Clans, and the names are escaping my mind right now. But a few other apps, all games, all very similar. And you can see that what they added, those really, really expensive ads during the Super Bowl to those ranks, were actually negligible. They were not very meaningful. So it may help in the case of Monument Valley and House of Cards, but it may not in the case of the Super Bowl. So again, I think it really depends on your audience and segmenting them properly.
Clash of Canes, Game of War, and Heroes Charge, I think is what you have on the blog post. Yep. I'm looking. A little, little cheating here.
That's fine.
But yeah, so I guess, so what's final advice to somebody who it wants to create an app and they want the best way to potentially promote that app? How should they go about, what would you suggest that they do first in developing a marketing strategy?
Oof, the million-dollar question again. One, build an app that wows its users and that gives them real value. They will take that and they will really push it for you. Two, give them the right price. The right price doesn't add risk. It actually reduces risk. And when you do that, in reducing risk, you'll make it easier for them to jump on board. So whether that means standing up with your icon or listening to them after they purchase the app, or even giving them a video so they can see the interaction with the app. The more you can do to really catch them on that app store page, the better. And then after they get the app, listening to them will also go a long way to creating really loyal customers.
I love it. If somebody wants to follow you, maybe they want to check out App Figures. Maybe they want to follow you on Twitter.
You should.
Or maybe they want to follow, find you on Tinder. What? Yep, that's right. He's single, ladies. what's the best way they can do that?
I'm my name on Twitter, Ariel McKaylee, at Ariel McKaylee, I should say. I also blog at arielmckaylee.com in case you want to read about the industry, apps, startups, and business in general. And you can check out App Figures at appfigures.com. If you're a developer, you're going to get great tools to make sense of all your App Store data. And if you're not a developer, we will get great tools to look at App Store data of other apps and see how they're doing. So goodness for everyone.
It's all about the data, right?
It's all about the data. I just like data myself. So that's what everything revolves around.
It's all about the data, about the data. What?
That's going to be a successful song in some circles.
I'm just saying. In my circles, my geeky circles. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Ariel. We really appreciate it and taking the time educate us. And
I really had fun.
We'll be checking out App Figures for sure.
Sounds good.
All right. That was Ariel McKaylee. He is the founder and CEO of App Figures. He's got a great background and experience in startups and really understands how to make something work. And like I said, ladies, he's single, so check him out. He's probably going to kill me for that. But if you want to follow me, you can do that too. You can find me on Twitter at Tanya Hall Radio or find me on Facebook. I'd love your feedback. You can email me with your questions, suggestions. That's where we get a lot of ideas for the show and who we're going to talk about, who's being successful, who maybe has some answers for you on how to create a marketing strategy for your software, your product, whatever you're doing. We're going to get those questions from you by emailing us at mavericks@twit.tv. That's mavericks@twit.tv. I do appreciate your feedback. And if you have a tip or maybe a suggestion, and you can certainly email, which you do already. But if you want to take a picture of something that you've done or an ad that you really like, maybe even create a Vine video, we'd love to show them here on our show. So send those to us at mavericks@twit.tv. I'm Tanya Hall. I'm your host. And have a good one. Until next week. Thanks for tuning in.